Accession number 27083, Reel 8.
I'm sorry, Sir Henry, are you referring to the fact that you wanted to... You were trying to decide what to do with Mauritius?
Well, yes. No, it was a moot point, because by this time the Japanese were coming over nightly and tossing bombs fairly indiscriminately. Didn't do a great deal of damage. But, for example, one morning one woke up and instead of the usual clamour and hustle and bustle of the dockyard, there was a deathly hush, because there had been a few bombs scattered around overnight, and all the labour, all the native labour, had panicked and run off into the Ulu, into the jungle. So the decision was taken that we should pick up our bits from the various shops in the dockyard and raise steam and undock, move out into the stream, and under cover of darkness go down the straits, by which time hopefully most things would be working, and as fast as we could leg it for Colombo. That was the plan. And all this was duly carried out. And on the day that we were due to undock and sail, it was in the afternoon, and routinely at 2:30, stand easy was piped, and the seamen, everybody really, went off to their messes for a 10 minutes break and a cuppa. And I mentioned earlier that the commander was not, shall I say, very brilliant with people. Unlike the chief person's mate, who was the father figure and a marvellous man. And he came to the commander in the course of Stand Easy and said, "Sir, are you aware that not a stroke of work is going on the upper deck of this ship?" And we were supposed to be preparing for sea, to go to sea that evening. And so instead of just sounding out pipes, hands carry on with the work, they fell all the seamen in to find out what the problem was. And the problem was a cat. We already had three cats in Mauritius. I can even remember their names. They were all tabbies, and they were called Hodge, Moose, and Christensen. And they were very mediocre specimens of cathood. But in the course of the intervening, whatever it was, 2-3 days, of course, Mauritius sailors and Prince of Wales survivors had got together in the canteen, and various yarns were exchanged and so forth. And although they hadn't thought about it at the time, some of the Prince of Wales survivors recalled that shortly before they had sailed for what turned out to be the last time, their cat, which was black, had been seen to walk ashore over the brow, the gangway, onto the jetty. And they thought nothing of it. But later, in the light of what had happened, they wondered. Well, that was Prince of Wales' story. Mauritius' story was that the previous day, a cat, which was black, so it had to be the Prince of Wales' cat, walked on board across the brow, walked on board Mauritius. They thought nothing of it. But that very afternoon, a cat, which was black, which had to be the same Prince of Wales' cat, was seen to walk ashore over the brow. And so they said, what the hell's the point in our working? We're all dead men. And this is quite interesting, because it's not all that long ago, 1941. And, of course, the ship had to be prepared for sea and so forth. But also, working parties, search parties were formed to search for the bloody cat. And they didn't find it. And, you know, the atmosphere in that ship was almost tangible. And the tails were vertically down. They were all dead men. Any thinking person reckoned that when we slipped down the straits under cover of darkness that night, and when dawn broke next day, we expected to be subjected to a submarine attack and air attack and possibly even surface attack by then. So that was the feeling when we went down the straits, and it wasn't a healthy one.
And what was the date that you left to get on the straits?
I'm guessing slightly, but let's say it was the disaster occurred on the 10th. So let's say it was the 14th. That sort of thing. It was 3 or 4 days later.
No premonition yet at this stage that Singapore might fall, of course. No one yet had that.
No, it hadn't. No.
Even though Malaya had been invaded.
No, it hadn't. Anyway, we got through the night, we got clear of the straits, and the further we went, the more we picked up speed and the machinery was proved and that sort of thing. And dawn came, and we never saw a submarine, we never saw an aircraft, we never met any surface craft. And that night, sometime during the first dog, about 1700, and I was on watch on the bridge, open bridge. And by this time, we'd picked up to a sort of 25, 28 knots. And we're legging it for Colombo. And an awful sort of roar welled up from further forward and somewhere down in the ship. And as the midshipman of the watch, I was sent down to find out what it was all about. And the further down and the further forward, the closer you got to it, the more recognizable did it become. And it was cheering. They'd found the cat. Straight away, up went the tails, and they were vertically up now. And we made it to Colombo. We spent Christmas there. And then we came back to UK. And shortly after that, I left the ship on arrival in UK, and went off to do my midshipman's 3 months small ship time. And I'll come to that in my next thing. So I reckon that was about number four of my nine lives. Edinburgh, Fiji, Prince of Wales now, and Mauritius. As to Singapore and so forth, I think the less said, the better. It was, from beginning to end, it was a disgraceful performance. There is, as I'm sure you're aware of, a normal, widely accepted, as it were, rule of thumb that in order to conduct an assault or even an effective defense, in ground force terms, you need to outnumber the enemy by not less than 3 to 1. We did. But we had not done, we'd hardly done any jungle training. It was unpleasant, it was hot, and it was full of mozzies and other horrors and so forth. And we simply hadn't done it. The Japanese were extremely skillful at it. And it was the most shameful performance. I hate to say that about another service, but it was. And there it was. So we lost Singapore. And that's the end of that. I've enough to say. I've said enough about Mauritius, because I left the ship as soon as we arrived home and went off to the Sardonyx, which is my next scene.
The Sardonyx.
Sardonyx. Sardonyx. The sardonyx was a very elderly, I think pretty well, World War I destroyer. She was small, she was old-fashioned, she had very little equipment. She was still capable of 29 knots, and she had a 14-charge depth charge pattern, which was not nothing. The rest was pretty hydraulic. The bridge, remarkably, was enclosed, which didn't come to other destroyers until into the late 60s.
Can I just ask you, what was the thinking behind the design of ships that had open bridges? What was the point of them? Exposing
the idea was that you wouldn't see things properly if you were enclosed in glass and structure. And yet, it wasn't applied throughout because the big ships had enclosed bridges. But even the previous counties, my father was captain of the Cumberland, the old Cumberland, 10,000 tons. But you had an open bridge. So it wasn't until, I'm trying to think which the first ones were, Belfast and Edinburgh were open bridges. Mauritius, the Fiji class, they were all open bridges. And that was the theory, I think. And what people, or certainly what the designers, and it wasn't the designers' fault so much as those supervising the designers, who themselves had been to sea in open bridges and so forth, and they ought to have known better. And certainly in a destroyer, in the North Atlantic, North Sea, and so forth, Arctic in particular, when it was blowing at all, and you kicked up a bit of wet, and it froze at once, and so on. And within half an hour, no matter what you put on, within half an hour of going on watch, you really got to the point where you didn't care. And by no manner of means were you efficient. You weren't.
No.
You couldn't. But so, the sardonyx and her class, of which there were very few remaining, only about three, did have a sort of closed bridge. It was rather like a poor man's greenhouse. And it was literally bits of wood and canvas and glass, but it was enclosed. And it was the nerve center of the ship. It was the bridge. So it had the main compass. It had an ASDIC cabinet, as it then was, sonar, in one corner. It was, it had a chart table. It had a radar scan, which was so basic that they might as well not have had it. It was the communications center. It was the computer room. We had a, what did we have? I think we had a single 4-inch gun or something, which was practically a muzzle loader. The fire control equipment was a Vickers clock and a Dumeric. You can't get more basic than that. There was nothing automatic about it. That was all on the bridge. The wheel was on the bridge. So it was the wheel house as well, and so on. And nevertheless, when you put to sea, we operated out of Londonderry, and when you once got to the mouth of the Foyle, and the ship began to lift with the ocean a bit, The wardroom was 3 inches underwater, always. I slept in a hammock over the wardroom table. The doctor, the young VR doctor, slept on the wardroom table. So he had to be shaken every time for the next meal, and so forth. The gunner with whom I kept watch was a temporary gunner who suffered acutely from seasickness, and he would go on onto the bridge. Once he put to sea, that was it for him. We didn't see him, apart from when he was on watch. He ate nothing but dry biscuits, which didn't help his complaint. On the bridge, he would chain smoke. I don't know how he did it, but he did. The navigator was an RNVR lieutenant who was, in fact, an American. Not an American naval officer, but he couldn't wait for America to come in the war, and he joined RNVR. And he was a very good navigator. I come on to the captains in a moment. The first lieutenant was a man called Henry Hewlett. He was an RNVR lieutenant. He must have been about 6'4" tall. He had an utterly smooth baby's bottom face. I mean, he shaved, and I don't think he had to, about once a month. He was a very fine officer, an extremely nice man, and a very good first lieutenant. Which is more than one could have said for the commanding officers. There were three in my time there. To begin with, there was an RN lieutenant commander who was on the bottle hard. He was a ditzo. At sea, he slept in an armchair, in a deck chair, which got in everybody's way, on the bridge. Didn't seem to make much odds. He was relieved, after a couple of weeks after I joined, by a splendid man called Falcon Stewart, who went on to better things and shortly afterwards became a commander. He was RN. He was very good. He's particularly good to me because he was constantly making me do things to test me out and sharpen me up and that sort of thing. He was absolutely first class. But he was only with us for 3 weeks. And he was relieved by an old-fashioned RNR. And by old-fashioned, I mean with the two intertwined things, the old RNR, man, lieutenant commander, who had come from an ocean boarding vessel operating out of Liverpool. And he was a dipso.
Double up.
He was a hypo. He was a hypo, not a dipso. And he would be saying he'd summon his pantry hand, his steward, as it were. We didn't have separate stewards in that ship. Go down to my bathroom, and the third bottle of pills, which are pink, from the left in the fourth shelf, and that sort of thing, blah, blah, blah. And then he'd munch these things, and so he was useless. But notwithstanding all this, she was a very happy ship. We were based on Londonderry. We did the Russian convoy as far as we could, but we hadn't the legs to go the whole way. So we would pick them up in Loch Ewe, take them towards Iceland, take them beyond as far as we could, then go back to Iceland to refuel, and back to Loch Ewe, and so on.
How many Russian convoys did you do?
I don't know. Several.
You weren't involved in any of the... Presumably because you didn't have the legs, you weren't involved in any of the really unpleasant ones.
No, we weren't. We couldn't get that far.
No.
We had a splendid young, very Irish surgeon lieutenant doctor, who, as I said just now, slept on the wardroom table. And he was invaluable because he had almost impeccable relations with the customs and the police at Londonderry. And so when we were going on boiler cleaning leave, he would sit up the whole of the night before playing poker with them on the jetty, and there was never any trouble. But we had trouble with our captain, and we were coming back down the Minches one day, and the Minches were divided into two halves. I forget which way round it was, and it doesn't matter. But one half was for northbound traffic, and the other half was southbound traffic. And only a proportion of the lights were lit, and not lit to full brilliance because of it being wartime. Our American navigator was absolutely first class. He was a very nice man, and he was very effective at his job, extremely. And he'd been in the ship for a year or more, so he knew the ship and he knew the sort of pattern of operating of the ship absolutely backwards. And we were coming back down the Minches one night, early part of the night, sort of 9 o'clock, with pitch dark, of course. And he had an argument with the captain, who told him that he knew those waters like the back of his hand, and there was no north and southbound channels at all. And eventually the navigator shut up with sheer sort of frustration and said, well, no, there was this separation, and so forth. And about 9 o'clock that night, 2100, of course we were dark and we didn't show navigation lights, and the Kent, who was one of the cruiser squadron's flagships, the old Kent, was rushing north to get back to Scarpa at 30 knots plus, and we were in her side of the channel. And she made a very rude signal as she passed. And the captain was sent for, and the navigating officer was sent for, and everybody was sent for. And there was a dreadful, a shameful heave-ho. And the captain eventually realized that he'd got this pretty badly wrong. And that was that. So there was a row, but on we went. And then I was on watch for, I suppose it was the middle watch, midnight to 04, with the gunner. And the gunner, who'd again done this trip, self-same trip, time and time again, was really amusing himself by fixing the ship navigationally, unnecessarily frequently. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, up came the captain, because he had indigestion or something, and he always had something. Said to the gunner, what's that light? And the gunner knew exactly what the light was and could have pointed out in the chart, but couldn't immediately produce its name. And so he said, and made to go to the chart. And the captain blew his top, a very elderly, 2.5 R&R. You don't know what it is. We're lost. And he sort of raved like this. And the navigating officer was sent for. And the first lieutenant was sent for. Everybody was sent for. And the navigating officer came to the bridge first because he slept close by. And the captain sort of shouted at him, fix the ship, we're lost. And he just took one, Lee was his name, that he took one quiet look round and recognised the characteristics of the light, and he put a fix on the chart, which was slap on top of the gunner's recent fish, because he'd been doing it so often. And have you fixed the ship? Yes, sir. Or, where are we? And all that sort of stuff. I don't believe it. Fix the ship again. So he fixed the ship again, which was barely a couple of minutes passed, and so we were almost same place. And again, he reported to the captain. By this time, the first lieutenant was on the bridge, wondering what the hell was going on. And reported to the captain, and the captain again screamed at him, nonsense, we're lost. Fix the ship again. I well remember this American navigator. He placed his feet firmly apart and he put his hands at his hips. And he said, Captain, I fixed the ship 3 minutes ago. I fixed the ship 2 minutes ago. I fixed the ship now. And I'm buggered if I'm going to fix the ship anymore. And he walked off the bridge. Whereupon the captain absolutely smoke coming out of his ears, and believe it or not, we turned round and we went all the way back up the Minches, had to change sides of course, and we got that message. And even if we'd anchored, we couldn't have done actually because it was deep water, but if we'd anchored where we were, we would have been further on towards towards Londonderry at 8 o'clock next morning, than by going the long way around. On the way back to Londonderry, and of course the bus got round the ship pretty quickly in the ship that size, we very nearly ran aground on a rock called Skerry Vaw there, and so on. And Jack, who was not all that good, because we hadn't come very close to the wall, and he wasn't very good at even wearing his life belts, the ordinary little sort of tubular blow-up things. And they were a bit uncomfortable and so forth. And when we entered the foil, the cable party on the forecastle, which was as close to the bridge as that dining table is up here, and you could hear every word that was spoken by the cable party. And one after another would say, Pierre, I'm just going below to put on my life belt. Never been known before, and that sort of thing. And so it went on. So that was not which was a happy ship, but it was a very curious one. I had a terrific send-off, even though I was only a midshipman, I'd only been there 3 months, and I gave them some rather ghastly pictures for the wardroom. And I had commented in fairly unexpurgated form in my journal, which I had to write. And so I said things like, we careered down the outside and we nearly ran aground off Skerry Vaw and one or two other little things like that. And that did not go down well with the captain. And when I told you some of this earlier on, when I came to take leave of him in Londonderry and go back to another ship after at the end of my 3 months, he handed me my journal, in which he had scribbled things like not true, never, and so forth in the margin. He'd done it in pencil, which was rather stupid of him. And he thrust it into my hands and glared at me. We never became friends, and said, don't you dare rub any of it out. And I looked him straight in the eyes and said, sir, I wouldn't dream of it. And in due course, the secretary gave me my so-called flimsy, my sort of personal little chit of a confidential report, which is supposed to represent the official thing in substance. And I remember this saying, during which time he has conducted himself, and that's printed, and he filled in the rest and said, to my entire satisfaction, stop, will undoubtedly go a long way if cured of his marked intolerance. And I'm not sure they've been entirely cured of it yet. And that was the end of my time in sardonyx.